This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents The Monk and the Riddle, The Art of Creating a Life While Making a Living by Randy Commissar. This is the author. Every moment, some form grows, perfect in hand or face. Some tone on the hills or the sea is choicer than the rest. Some mood of passion or insight or intellectual excitement is irresistibly real and attractive to us. For that moment only. Not the fruit of experience, but experience itself is the end. A counted number of pulses only is given to us of a variegated, dramatic life. How may we see in them all that is to be seen in them by the finest senses? How shall we pass most swiftly from point to point and be present always at the focus where the greatest number of vital forces unite in their purest energy? To burn always with this hard, gem-like flame, to maintain this ecstasy, is success in life. Walter Pater, Studies in the History of the Renaissance, 1873. Preface to the New Edition. Postmortem. In the time since Ken Leinbach and I sat down to write The Monk and the Riddle, things have certainly changed dramatically. The millennium celebration marked a decade of prosperity that boiled over into giddy enthusiasm for a future limited only by our imaginations. The internet epitomized this boundless optimism and permeated every corner of the media. The stock market became the barometer of our exuberance. But today, people fear the future with the guilt of a child who has had too much fun and expects to pay the price. The internet bubble of the late 1990s saw the NASDAQ soar to over 5,000 and then fall to less than 2,000. Dot-coms were proclaimed the monarchs of the so-called new economy, and then the blue chips of the technology industry, such as Cisco, Oracle, and Microsoft, traded near 52-week lows. In 1999, venture capitalists could not get their fill of dot-coms, and in 2001, promising ideas and teams starved without capital. During the boom, carpetbaggers and speculators poured into startups, pronouncing themselves smart and rich. But in the wake of the dot-com bankruptcies and layoffs, many young wannabes were slinking off to work their way up the corporate ladder instead. Day traders once exchanged suits for t-shirts and tasseled loafers for sandals, making money thoughtlessly as they clicked away on keyboards. But after the bust, they were all but washed out. And looking back today, it seems like an eternity since Amazon's Jeff Bezos smiled at us triumphantly from the cover of Time as 1999's Man of the Year, only to downsize and jettison unpromising business units just to stay afloat. What the heck happened? I wish I could say that I saw all of this coming. Like a few other skeptics, I felt certain that the dot-com bubble would burst. The monk, in fact, employs the metaphors of death and funerals not just to poke fun at the silly excesses of the mania, but more importantly, to foreshadow its demise. Still, the severity of the boom and bust, the polarity of investor optimism and pessimism, and the devastating impact on the best of companies surprised even me. When I started to write The Monk, I was unsure of how the book would be received by my close friends and associates, as well as by the market at large. I felt distinctly alone looking the dot-com gift horse in the mouth. I had partaken of its gifts most willingly and was not happy to conclude that they were unsustainable. But people I greatly respect were certain that I was becoming alarmist. I wrote the book anyway. I focused on a critical weak link in the chain, the human side, the entrepreneurs and their motivations. While investors, analysts, entrepreneurs were mesmerized by the brilliant horizons of the new economy, I questioned whether the rickety ships we had launched with their inexperienced captains could ever get there. While the market momentum seemed inexhaustible, I wondered if beyond greed there was enough passion to fortify the startup crews when the seas got rough. And they always do. Business is tough. Tenacity and endurance are key to business success. But tenacity is seldom sustained simply by the drive for riches. Endurance most often wanes in the face of persistent obstacles if money is the overwhelming objective. During this time of reflection and commercial penance, the messages of the monk seem more applicable than ever. No matter how hard we work or how smart we are, our financial success is ultimately dependent on circumstances outside our control. Ask any once high-flying startup that is currently looking for a life-saving round of financing in bleak times. In order to find satisfaction in our work, therefore, we should train our attention on those things that we can influence and that matter to us personally. The monk encourages us to consider how we spend our time, not our money. Marrying our values and passions to the energy we invest in work, it suggests, increases the significance of each moment. Consider your budget of time in terms of how much you're willing to allocate to acquiring things versus how much you're willing to devote to people, relationships, family, health, personal growth, and the other essential components of a high-quality life. Rather than working to the exclusion of everything else in order to flood our bank accounts in the hope that we can eventually buy back what we have missed along the way, we need to live life fully now with a sense of its fragility. If money ultimately cannot buy much of life's total package anyway, why waste precious time earning more for its own sake? The monk encourages us to make work pay, not just in cash, but in experience, satisfaction, and joy. These sources of contentment provide their own rewards and are durable in the face of adversity. We still have an opportunity to retune the balance between passion and drive, to express ourselves holistically in what we do, rather than to defer what is important until it is too late. Don't be mistaken. Following your passion is not the same as following your bliss. While passion is a font of expressive, creative energy, it won't necessarily deliver pleasure and contentment at every moment. Success, even on your own terms, entails sacrifice in periods of very hard work. Following your passion will not necessarily make you rich, but then again, it won't hurt your chances either, since most people are far more successful working at things they love. You have to engage passion realistically, with an eye toward what is achievable, given your circumstances. I have been delighted and gratified by the ardent response to the messages in the monk. I heard from a young woman who had pursued the big payoff by working at a series of failed startups. The monk reinforced her feeling that life is too short to spend it chasing elusive riches, and she left her job to try her hand at her passion, writing. A professor in Texas wrote and produced a marvelous short performance piece, a monologue, exploring the deferred life plan. A number of entrepreneurs on the money-raising trail told me that after reading The Monk, they had been emboldened to focus on the lasting value they wished to create rather than on their exit strategy. Many educators have included The Monk in their courses to encourage their students to think more holistically about their careers. And a few of the most respected venture capitalists let me know that The Monk captured the underlying passion and reason for doing what they do, the chance to turn ideas into viable enterprises that can change the world and to prosper in the process. I've heard from people who agree wholeheartedly with the messages of the monk, but question whether they apply only to a select few privileged with substantial options regarding work and career. Surely things are different for an underskilled single mother of three, barely scraping by on minimum wage. But even so, there are people who tell me that the monk has inspired them to improve their circumstances, to find jobs that are more consistent with their interests and values, to learn new skills that provide satisfaction and growth, to reach for more rewarding opportunities and engaging challenges. I'm reminded that finding meaning and fulfillment in one's work should not be an elitist notion. A few readers were disappointed that the monk never attempts to address specifically how to create a successful business. I don't have a prescription for financial success, nor do I think one exists. In truth, the monk is not primarily a business book. That is, it is not about buying low and selling high, but rather about creating a life while making a living. It is about the need to fashion a meaningful existence that engages you in the time and place in which you find yourself. It is about the purpose of work and the integration of what one does with what one believes. The monk is not about how, but about why. Since The Monk was published, I've ridden my bicycle across the extremely challenging Himalayan landscape of Bhutan, a country that measures its prosperity by gross national happiness rather than gross national product. Things are different there. The volume is turned down, the clock slowed. The pace of life is gentle. Fancy things are few and far between, but those precious qualities of life that seem to vanish in a Western society intent on measuring everything are not forgotten in Bhutan. It was a gorgeous adventure. As I am wont to do, I spent some time visiting several Tibetan-style Buddhist monasteries that are home to communities of friendly monks in crimson robes. At one point, I had the rare privilege of an audience with a distinguished 80-year-old lama who practiced the art of medicinal Buddhism. His nephew made the introduction and interpreted for us. Two friends and I sat in a semicircle at the foot of the lama's raised platform. The temple was dark, streaked with smoky light that gave the room a mystical air. Behind us was an altar of large sitting Buddhas. Yak butter lamps sputtered in the foreground. The main walls were covered in beautiful paintings detailing Buddha's life and the introduction of Buddhism to Bhutan by Guru Rinpoche some 1,300 years ago. Many of the images were tantric, depicting the struggling union of wisdom and compassion in the orgasmic joining of man and woman. The paintings were covered by colorful wall hangings to protect them from the elements in untrained minds. Elephant tusks arced heavenward at the corners of the altar, a reference to the crucial role of the white elephant in the birth of the Buddha. Before us sat this lovely old lama, a few days' growth on his chin and head. He constantly stroked his scalp, luxuriating in the feel. His teeth were obviously not all there, and he scrunched his lower jaw in the fashion of an old man who has forgotten his dentures. His once white long johns showed under his heavy robe, insulating him from the early morning chill. Behind him, the light penetrated through the filthy old windows that looked out 14,000 feet over the valley and beyond. All around the windows were piles and piles of bright red chilies, hot chilies, to warm the Bhutanese bellies and hide the blandness of their cuisine. Each member of my party was permitted to ask the lama one question. I would come last. As each query was made in turn, I use the time to come up with a question worthy of such an eminence. What could I possibly ask that would not embarrass me by its triviality? How could I tap this holy man's wisdom? Finally, it was my turn. The Lama looked down at me with compassion and perhaps a little boredom. His nephew stared at me imploringly. I sat quiet. After a long moment, I asked softly, "Your Holiness, with your great age, experience, and wisdom, you have encountered many things. You have certainly answered many questions. What question still perplexes you? When you sit in meditation, what question do you still ask yourself?" The Lama's nephew wrinkled his brow and haltingly translated my question. He launched into an explanation far lengthier than my own, while the old Lama nodded, peering occasionally in my direction. I feared I might have crossed a boundary, perhaps offended him. But after an instant of contemplation, the old Lama turned to me and fixed his eyes on mine. Then he spoke gently and ended with the lilt of a question in his indecipherable Bhutanese. He continued to stare into me as his nephew said simply, "The Lama says he still doesn't understand why people are not kinder to each other." That was it. We got up, slowly, made our bows, climbed down the steep ladder to the dark, cold living quarters and the walled, open-air courtyard. As we entered into the bright morning light, we could see the clouds dispersing from the valley. The young monks went about their business, sweeping the grounds and cleaning the morning dishes, smiling at us whenever we caught their eyes. As we left the compound and started down the mountain, we turned to see the old Lama staring at us and waving from his dirty, chili-festooned windows, still fondling his scratchy scalp and munching down on his toothless jaw. Another monk, another riddle. And as with the monk and the riddle, the answer lies not in dollars and cents, but in who we are and what we believe. The Riddle. It's February, 1999, and I'm motorcycling across the most arid expanse of Burma, now officially Myanmar. The boundless landscape is relieved only by one ribbon of life, the rich river basin of the Ai Irrawaddy that drains the Himalayas and wears a groove through the middle of this starkly beautiful country. My destination is Bagan, an ancient city studded with more than 5,000 temples and stupas, over 30 square kilometers. The group I've been traveling with, American bicyclists mostly, are far ahead. Having loaned my bicycle to one of my compatriots whose bike never arrived for the trip, I have been waylaid and detoured pleasantly for hours. I spot a makeshift taxi ahead, a rickety Chinese-made truck onto which 30 or so passengers are clinging and clamoring. Many of the riders, men and women alike, wear colorful longis, simple pieces of cotton or silk that have been sewn into loops and resemble long skirts, to reflect their tribal affiliations. Most of the women and some of the men have streaked their cheeks, foreheads, and noses with a mud-like paste made from the bark of the tanka tree, which serves as both cosmetic and sunscreen. Standing on the rear bumper is a young monk, his plum robes pulled over his head to block the sun. He motions toward me, communicating emphatically, if wordlessly. He wants a ride on the motorcycle. I nod in equally silent assent and stop angling to pass the truck, instead trailing it until it stops to lose some and gain some. The monk hops off the truck happily and walks slowly toward me, flashing a warm, penetrating smile. Unleashing my backpack from the seat behind me, I gesture for him to put it on. He dons it and tries to shove a wad of grimy, threadbare bills, kyat, into my hand. "Just get on the back," I say, and then realize that he speaks no English. So I wave my palm and shake my head, no. Gently, his hand rests on my shoulder. We take off, quickly overtaking the pickup truck. The monk's robes flutter in the rush of air that gives us both relief from the scorching midday sun. Half an hour down the road, we come upon my cycling friends, lunching at a little roadside inn, a dirt-floored shack wallpapered with faded posters of Hong Kong beauties and faraway beaches. They are clearly amused that I have been adopted by one of Buddha's apprentices. One by one, they approach to greet my new companion, meet the insurmountable language barrier, and retreat to their plates of pungent stir-fry. "You want some lunch?" I ask in a crude sign language that has served me well in my travels. He shakes his head and slips off to a corner of the table. He might be able to manage one American, but 20 overwhelm him. I offer him a plate of my curry, but he won't touch it, preferring to sip at a sickeningly sweet local soda pop. He waits. I wolf down my lunch, because I can tell he's ill at ease. He redons the pack, and we are back on the motorcycle, tooling down the road. His soft touch on my shoulder lets me know he's still there, but except for the buzz of the two-stroke Japanese engine, we travel without a sound. More endless highway. A scattering of thatched houses on stilts. An occasional open-air market. We slow down for water buffalo, pulling a caravan of carts and weave paths around lumbering herds of cattle who wander onto the road, their bells chiming in the dust. At this rate, we won't reach Bagan until after dark. Half an hour later, the monk signals me, with a tap on the shoulder, to pull over in front of a ramshackle, windowless shed. We enter a crowded room filled with farmers and loiterers, members of a full-fledged profession in Burma. The locals are excited to see an American where none usually tread. The monk sits down at a small bench and offers me lunch. I shake my head. Now it's my turn to wait, sipping green tea, cautiously, not understanding a word that is spoken. He sponges up the last bit of thick brown sauce with a wad of rice, and we take off again. Riding for hours, another 100 kilometers or so, we end up at Mount Popa, an ancient Buddhist temple built on a mountain of rock that erupts from an otherwise flat landscape. It's an old, shabby temple, popular with the monkeys. Gnats, humans who have suffered tragic deaths and have been transformed into animist deities, are worshipped side by side with Buddha here and are feted with offerings of fruit, cigarettes, and chewing gum. At night, trance dancers take on the spirits of the gnats in their gyrations. An older monk in sun-faded robes emerges from the temple's entrance, and the two greet each other with bows. My monk disappears quietly up the hill without so much as a peep in my direction. "I'm Mr. Wisdom, the abbot of Mount Popa Monastery," says the older monk. An angular man with day-old stubble on his pate, he wears crooked, wire-rimmed glasses that look like they've been mangled and bent back to form many times. I'm relieved to hear English. I have no idea where the hell I am, My bicycling buddies are long gone, and now I'm almost out of gas. With the noble hospitality of one who has nothing, Mr. Wisdom motions for me to sit down. You know, I picked him up 150 kilometers ago, and I have no idea where I'm taking him, I say, gesturing toward the one who disappeared. Is this where he wants to go? Oh, yes. This is where you take him, Mr. Wisdom replies, elliptically. We talk briefly, traveler's chit-chat, before I ask for and receive directions to Bagan. He hands me a dog-eared card, all unintelligible Burmese except for the odd English phonetic spelling of his name, Wisdom with a Z. Seeing that I'm not rushing to copy down the particulars, he snatches back what must be his one and only calling card. I accept a drink of water and shake Mr. Wisdom's hand. My work is done. I head back to my motorcycle to find the young monk waiting for me. Confused, I look plaintively toward Mr. Wisdom, who is gazing at us from the temple steps. He wants to go back to where you picked him up, Mr. Wisdom offers with a shrug. But you said this is where I take him, I call out. Yes, but he wants to go back, now. Can you take him? Mr. Wisdom comes forward, a monkey squealing behind him. For his part, the young monk reaches for my backpack, readying himself for another journey. But he just got here. I drove him all afternoon. It's nearly sunset. Now he wants to go back? What's the point? Bemused, Mr. Wisdom shrugs his shoulders again and turns back toward the temple. I cannot easily answer that question, but let me give you a riddle to solve. Pausing, he exchanges a smile with the young monk and turns back to me. I'm wondering how I ended up in a script with a monk named Mr. Wisdom and a magic riddle. Don't try to answer it now. You must sit with the riddle for a while, and the answer will simply come to you. The truth is, I don't much like such games, but the monk doesn't give me a choice in the matter. Imagine I have an egg, Mr. Wisdom cups an imaginary egg in his hand, and I want to drop this egg 3 feet without breaking it. How do I do that? The monk seems pleased with himself, having mustered enough English to perplex a simple American traveler. My mind flips fast through the forgotten pages of elementary science texts. I am tempted to blurt out answers, for if I solve Mr. Wisdom's riddle, perhaps he will explain what's going on. Instead, I take his instructions to heart and let it go, for now. With a final nod, Mr. Wisdom retreats, leaving the question with me as a souvenir of Mount Popa. We're back on the motorcycle, me and my wayward monk. This time, the monk leads me to gas. Forget gas stations in rural Burma. Instead, dusty bottles lined up at infrequent intervals along the side of the road, each with an old rag stuffed in the mouth like a wick. When you stop to fill up, local merchants mysteriously materialize to take your money. On we go, yo-yoing silently across the desert. As we approach Bagan, gorgeous brick and stone temples rise up everywhere, some reaching toward the sky, some so tiny you cannot enter without evicting the Buddha in residence. This intricately variegated line of pinnacles and spires is backlit by the fiery red sun dropping into the desert, the Irrawaddy ablaze from the sun's torch. We keep driving, looking for the old town and my hotel. It's been an exhausting, dusty, hot day on the road, but suddenly I'm delighted to be here. At sunset, cruising the wonders of Bagan on a motorcycle, a monk on my back. When we first left Mount Popa, I wanted nothing more than to get to my destination. But now I don't have the slightest desire for this trip to end. The answer comes to me. Chapter 1. The Pitch. We're going to put the fun back into funerals. With that declaration, the meeting began. It was a curious elevator pitch. "The fun back into funerals?" I asked. "Absolutely. We're going to make it easy to make choices when someone dies. You know, the casket, the liner, flowers, that kind of thing." "Fun?" "Sure. All those decisions? It's not easy. So why not use the internet?" "But fun? Why fun?" "Come on. Catchy marketing, you know, a play on words." "Ah, the F-U-N in funerals." "Right, that's it. How many hits do you think you get now if you put the words fun and funeral into Yahoo?"
"Hundreds?"
"I doubt it. You'll get one, just one. Us." Giving the pitch is a fellow named Lenny. Something about using the internet to sell items most people buy at a funeral home when someone dies. Items that arouse as many varied and complex feelings as sex toys. We are seated in the Konditorei, a comfy coffee shop nestled in bucolic Portola Valley. With the Santa Cruz Mountains to the west and Palo Alto and Route 280 to the east, we are but one exit away from Sandhill Road, the famous home to Silicon Valley venture capital. The Konditorei is where I meet people like Lenny, the pitchmen of the internet era. Here, or in a couple of restaurants in the same rustic strip mall. This is my office. Forget Buck's restaurant in next door Woodside. That's where venture capitalists prefer to meet supplicants and huddle around deals under a giant painting of Roy Rogers on Trigger rampant. If you sit in the corner of Buck's all morning, starting with the power breakfast crowd, you can quietly observe who is funding whom. It's a voyeur's embarrassment. Every morning, a stream of humanity stops at the Konditorei for coffee. Joggers fueling up, business people in a rush, Stanford students on their way to class, a handful of dealmakers en route from hillside homes to sandhill castles. It's also, ironically, a stop for the parade of incoming workers who saw, mow, paint, rake, and hammer away busily at the homes of the valley shakers. Porsches, Mercedes, and BMWs queue up to enter the freeway, indifferent to the oncoming line of pickup trucks that replaced them each morning. I had arrived a few minutes earlier, and Lenny was waiting for me. "You're Randy," he began.
"I'm Lenny. Frank said you'd be easy to spot."
Shaved head, cowboy boots, jeans, motorcycle jacket. I seldom get mistaken at these blind dates. With a solid grip, he shook my hand. Then, his left hand on my elbow like a politician, he guided me to the table where he'd already set up shop. I could tell by his amped-up confidence that he was probably not an engineer. Too outgoing, too well-dressed. "So it's not a technology pitch," I said to myself. I looked at my watch on the arm he didn't have in a power lock. 9 o'clock, exactly. "I hope I didn't keep you waiting," I said. "I had this down for 9.
9 is right. Come on," he commanded.
"I'll get you some coffee, my treat. You take cream? Sugar?" "Thanks. I don't know what I'll have. Why don't you sit down while I decide?" He started to resist, but I retrieved my arm and walked to the counter. He took one step to follow, but then turned and sat down.
I let out the breath I'd been holding since he grabbed my arm. I watched him askance as I waited for my low-fat chai latte, putting his age at 28. I took stock of his thick, blue-black hair and his pale and drawn face. He looked like he'd been pulling some all-nighters, and by noon he would need another shave. Beneath two smudges of eyebrows, his dark eyes gripped his target like his double-lock handshake. No gazing off and gathering his thoughts. He sat with his body coiled, tense, ready to spring. At me. Lenny's standard-issue corporate uniform, navy blue suit, crisp white shirt, tie, a rich mosaic of reds and yellows, pegged him as not from the valley. Sales guy, I guess. The only one in the Konditorei wearing a suit and tie. Personally, I hadn't worn a suit in years. When I was at Go Corporation, a few years ago, spending several months negotiating an investment in the company by IBM, my opposite number was one of their seasoned negotiators, Dick Seymour. He was a classic IBM fixer. The equivalent of foreign service diplomats, these fixers knew how to manage both the internal IBM organization, all the different inside stakeholders whose interests could often be at odds, and the outside oddballs, like us at Go. Seymour was probably in his 50s, fit, highly articulate, utterly professional, and impeccably dressed in a blue suit and crisp white shirt. There I was in my 30s, in jeans and a t-shirt and florid socks and skateboard shoes, going nose to nose on complicated deal points. Dick treated me like a professional through all our wrangling. Not as if I were a creature from a valley of lunatics. Go accepted some tough terms to get IBM support, but I came away with nothing but admiration for Dick. He had class. He was the consummate deal guy. For all his professional savvy and maturity, though, I couldn't ever imagine a guy like Dick founding a startup. Now I'm wondering whether Lenny is the corporate type, just younger than Dick and not yet so polished and accomplished. Connie leaned over the register as she handed me my chai. "Your friend want another cup of coffee?" she asked. "I don't know. Sure, you know what he takes?" "You bet. French roast, black," she whispered. "He's had 5 cups in the last hour. I'm surprised he can sit still at all. I hope you're wearing your surge protector today." With her sleeves rolled up to handle the morning onslaught, Connie still had time to offer some neighborly advice. When I rejoined him at his table, Lenny glanced at the coffee I put in front of him and laid a black 3-ring notebook in front of me. "Thanks" was obviously not in the script. "I usually make the presentation on a computer, you know, throw it up on the screen if I can. That's how Frank saw it. But I checked it out earlier. Too much glare in here, so we'll use the dead tree version." Here it comes. The pitch. People present ideas for new businesses to me 2 or 3 times a week. If I chose to, I could hear a pitch every day, all day, every day. Just as everyone in L.A. has a screenplay, everyone in Silicon Valley has a business plan. Most of them nowadays for internet businesses. I've been around Silicon Valley and involved with young companies since the early 80s. Startups, spin-outs, spin-ins, what have you. I'm not in the phone book or listed in any professional directory. If you don't know someone I know, you can't find me. I wonder what Frank had in mind when he set me up with Lenny. I prefer to riff on ideas, brainstorm, prod and provoke, have some constructive give and take around a business concept. It didn't feel like there was going to be much of that with Lenny. I gazed out the picture window at the bright California day, the eucalyptus trees rustling in the breeze. "Before you get started, Lenny, tell me how you know Frank," I said. He's a friend of a friend. We presented to him Monday, and he sounded interested. He wanted us to meet with you right away.
Sounds like the early bird special. A quick chat before Frank and his partners hold their weekly gathering to talk shop and audition new deals. Obviously, Lenny didn't know Frank at all.
Thanks, Frank. You owe me one.
Frank is a headliner in the VC world, whom I've known since I raised money for Go. His firm is top tier, a term reserved for firms with such a long wake of winners that the mere mention of their names imparts instant credibility and a whiff of a sure thing to a startup. We stay in touch. A few days ago, he called to say he was sending me a prospect. Intense guy, he confided. Unusual idea, but maybe interesting. If you like it, perhaps we can work together on this one.
What do you do, Lenny?
I sell group life insurance to companies, part of the employee benefit package. National accounts. So I'm out on the West Coast every 2 or 3 weeks. I'm the company leader in new sales the last 2 years. Millions of dollars in value.
Lenny paused a split second and slid some kind of legal document across the table.
I brought along an NDA. Could you please sign it before I go on? For a second, his supreme confidence faltered.
Without a glance, I pushed it back at Lenny.
I see dozens of companies each month, Lenny. I can't sign a confidentiality agreement. It exposes me to inadvertent liability. My integrity is my stock in trade. If Frank referred you, he can vouch for me. If you're uncomfortable with that, don't tell me anything you think is a trade secret.
Frank didn't sign your NDA, did he?
No, I just thought, Lenny said, skidding for a split second.
Okay, let me start.
He flipped open the binder. It was a professional presentation, the kind you see in boardrooms all the time. From his pocket, he extracted an extendable pointer. He pulled it out a few inches and tapped at the title page. We want to call this business funerals.com, but some undertaker in Oklahoma already has the URL, he said. When we get funding, we'll buy the rights to the name.
Funerals.com. Oh, brother. What next?
I understand, I said. Below the title were the date and the words, Presentation to Randy Commissar. He would probably read aloud all the words to me.
Presentation to Randy Commissar.
You don't need to read it to me, Lenny, I said. Just tell me about it.
Sure, if that's what you prefer.
He flipped to a page that proclaimed, in a blaze of black type, the Amazon.com of the funeral goods business.
Now that's a new one.
This window of opportunity is going to close soon, but if we act now, we can make this the Amazon of the funeral business, Lenny began. It's going to be big. The world is moving to the internet. I'll explain that in a minute, and these products will move there too. The internet's changing the way we live, and it will change the way people die. Someone's going to ride this opportunity all the way to the bank, or the pearly gates, I said to myself. And we think we should be the ones.
Next page. Projected revenues.
In the first full year after we're up and running, we expect $10 million in revenues, $50 million the second year. The third year, we really hit our stride, $100 million.
Lenny paused for effect.
Exciting, right? It's big.
He waited for my response, then leaned forward and whispered conspiratorially.
Most people don't like to talk about this.
Death, dying, loved ones passing on.
But that's part of the opportunity. You understand that, right? It's a competitive barrier, a hurdle to entry. Most people won't want to do this. Would you?
He looked at me, but didn't wait for an honest response.
I wouldn't, if I weren't so damn excited about it.
Until this last line, Lenny's pitch sounded like dozens of others I've heard.
everyone's going to be the Amazon or the Yahoo or the eBay of the you-fill-in-the-blank business. Manifest destiny. Millions, billions even, of dollars overnight. Then sell out or do an IPO and cash out. "You know what makes this business so exciting?" he asked. I waited. The warm spring air wafted through the open doors of the Konditorei. "People are dying, that's what. It's inevitable. Death and taxes, right?" "Doesn't matter, rich or poor, what you believe, where you live, how you live, what you think. In the end, everybody has to die sometime. And we're going to be there, ready to provide the goods that people have to buy. They must buy. That's the point, you understand. This isn't about eyeballs visiting your site. These aren't eyeballs. These are people who need what funerals.com has, because everybody dies. And when somebody dies, there has to be one final shopping day to assuage a life of guilt. To buy all those things, expensive things, high-margin things." He thumped the table and stressed "things" every time he said it. "All these things, expensive things, and there's no getting around it. These are necessities aimed at the biggest aggregate market in the world. Biggest because it includes everyone. Everyone." He paused again for effect. "That's the business, and it's a dream business, because you don't have to convince anybody they need what you have. They know it, brother, they know it. We sell the solution everyone ultimately wants. No demand creation, just redirect it. To us." I looked around the coffee shop, sheepishly. Lenny should have asked everyone in the Konditorei to sign non-disclosure agreements. Sure, he might never see these people again, but these are my homies. Connie rolled her eyes. Having overheard so many pitches herself, she knew the drill cold. Next page. A shaded graph, probably sold ready-made in any office superstore in the country. The shameless projected growth chart inevitably traces the outline of a hockey stick and assumes that a short period of investment will be obliterated by years of exponential increases in whatever. Revenues, net income, profits, customers, corpses. Lenny's chart was all about revenues, certainly not profits, because this was, after all, an internet business. 100 million, 3 years easy. Lenny poked his pointer at the highest end of the graph. Who knows how far it can go? The potential is unlimited. In 3 years, the exit strategy kicks in. Maybe an IPO? Depends on the stock market. Probably a buyout. Getting to $100 million of annual sales in 3 short years is no small task, I cautioned. I went on to explain that in the late 80s, I'd been one of the founders of a software company, Claris Corporation, that grew to nearly $90 million of annual run rate in 3 years, and we were profitable to boot. That was when $90 million was $90 million. Not like today, when $90 million in stock options alone is chump change. I remember all too well how much hard work and good fortune must come together to make that happen. Selling software? No offense, but what was that? $100 a pop? $200? This is thousands of dollars a sale. Thousands. I'm talking about an order of magnitude difference. No comparison. Besides, the numbers here only include the U.S., you understand that? The U.S. alone. But people die everywhere, right? Not just here. This is truly global. The world market for these goods is at the very least triple, quadruple the U.S. market. Tens of billions of dollars. Easy. I pictured some Tibetan ordering the hack into small pieces and feed to the vultures economy option. How would Lenny price that? Let me tell you something that I absolutely, positively, sincerely believe is the gospel truth,
Lenny leaned forward and focused on me with his dark gaze. "You would have to convince me," he tapped on his chest every time he said me, "convince me that these numbers are a stretch." "A stretch? I don't think so. Listen, somebody's going to do this, no doubt about it, and I say, why not us? Why not us?" Lenny obviously didn't ask questions to get answers, and so I waited through his dramatic pause. "And I'm not alone in this." He flipped to a page of quotes from analysts and forecasters. He started to read the first aloud, from Jeff Bezos, founder of Amazon.com, something about the migration of the $4 trillion global economy onto the Internet. I held up my hand so I could read in silence. In a world inhabited by people who think the Internet and the universe are converging, no shortage of proselytizers are willing to endorse any kind of cockamamie scheme as the next big thing. But Bezos deserved to be read. I noticed that he made no mention of funerals or caskets. "Have you been in a funeral home lately?" Lenny said suddenly. "Well, no," I confessed, "I hadn't." "Most people, they'd rather have a root canal. Research reveals that people think funeral homes are creepy places. Not good places for making decisions that can add up to the price of a small car. You're not there because something pleasant is happening in your life. You're there to see someone off, say goodbye. All the queasy questions you never ask yourself in daily life seem to be lurking in the next room, waiting to leap out and grab you by the throat. You know, what happens when you die? Is there life after death? Am I going to be called up next? If you could answer those questions on the Internet, I advised, that would be a great business. Oh, there are sites to claim to have the answers, but that's not what we're doing." Lenny would not be deterred, not with humor, not with questions, not with sidelong glances from strangers at the next table. "Then there's the guilt. You didn't call enough. You didn't stop in enough. You didn't help enough. Whatever you did, it wasn't enough. Now, by God, your dearly departed dad is going to have the casket of his dreams." He paused and glared at me, slightly indignant. Was I supposed to be the grieving fool about to spring for the most expensive casket, or the conniving funeral director profiteering from human suffering? "Have you ever heard the pitch?" "Your pitch? No, no, the spiel you get in a funeral home." "No, I never have." He brightened. "All right, let me set it up for you. Imagine suddenly someone's dead." Again, Lenny had everybody's attention. "Somebody important to you. You're in shock. Grief has you on your knees. But you're the one who has to make all the final arrangements. So first, you have to figure out where to go. You've never done this before. It's all new. If you belong to a church or a synagogue, you could ask the priest or rabbi. They would probably steer you to one or two homes. And it's not unknown, you know, for the funeral home to give the church a little something in return, by the way. And so you go there. Or you look up the Yellow Pages. Or an acquaintance says she knows somebody had a nice time over to Joe Blow's place. So tears in your eyes because a light is gone from your life, you head over there. You figure, they're all the same anyway, right? First thing, they say, we're here to help you. Help you? I doubt it. They're thinking when you walk through the door, before you walk through the door, about everything they can sell you. Cremation? Sure. How about a $12,000 casket? Let's burn that up, too. Show some respect. Oh, then there are sealed caskets. I love this. Buy one of those, just a few bucks more, so you can seal the old guy away from all that water and dirt underground. But when you seal it, the anaerobic bacteria can have a feast. Putrefaction sets in. A little far, I thought, for an eating establishment. They'll never let me back in. Lenny, I interrupted, does it make sense to go down this road? Just give me the conclusions. I didn't feel like hearing any more of the standard funeral home pitch.
Wait a minute, someone two tables over called out. What about those anaerobic bacteria?
Connie shushed him.
But you've never heard the spiel, Lenny continued. That's what you said.
I don't need the experience. Most of your customers won't have had the experience either.
If your market is only people who've been suckered in their first funeral, that's not a ready market.
He was undeterred.
From his file, he pulled out a four-color brochure and spread it in front of me. I suppressed a grin. Even if I did seem to be the sole focus of his sepulchral cell, I had to admire his spirit. He knew what he wanted, and nothing was going to stop him. I could more than relate to Lenny's single-minded sincerity. Years ago, when I was a young lawyer new to Silicon Valley, I represented a client in an arbitration hearing. Contrary to what you see in the movies or sensational TV trials, many legal proceedings are blandly cordial affairs conducted by lawyers who know each other socially, belong to the same private clubs, and break bread together. Trial histrionics can be as phony as professional wrestling. But I cared very little back then for the lawyer's code of civility. My job was to win for my client, and I was willing to do whatever that took, even if it irritated everybody else in the courtroom. I challenged nearly every one of my opponent's assertions and failed to show respect for my esteemed adversary, a friend of the arbitrator and, unbeknownst to me, a pillar of the local bar association. At the end of the hearing, my boss, the lead partner in the case, turned to me shaking his head. "You're a lawyer's worst nightmare. A guy works all his life to rise above the fray, and you go for the jugular. You don't give a damn. You just want to win." He was bemused and dismayed at the same time. I suppose it's the privilege of youth to be admired and admonished by the wise guys who have gone before. Lenny pressed on. The brochure showed the latest fashions in caskets. Metal caskets in pink and blue with matching satin lining, walnut caskets lined in white satin, and even some Greek sarcophagus-looking numbers. They all had model names like cars. Peaceful Rest, Solitude, Heavenly Gates.
"Is there one called Handbasket?" I asked.
"Handbasket? As in, go to hell in a handbasket?" He didn't even blink. "Look at this, look at this." He took out two pens and began writing, upside down, so I could read what he wrote. Dollar numbers next to each casket. It's a trick used by presenters to keep your attention while they write. So far, Lenny had shown me his mastery of the inevitable growth curve, and now the magic upside-down writing trick. Somewhere in his pitch, if I could wait long enough, Lenny would surely reduce the entire world to a four-cell matrix. Granted, Lenny struggled a little in writing the upside-down numbers, switching back and forth between red and black pens. He wrote two shaky but legible numbers by each casket. "The red number is the price typically charged by the funeral home," he said finally. "Those numbers ranged anywhere from just under $1,000 to several thousand dollars. The black number is the cost to the funeral home. Those numbers were all in hundreds of dollars, some in low hundreds. The margins these guys get are unconscionable. Markups of 13, 14 times cost. They get away with it because nobody feels like shopping around. Everybody thinks funerals have to cost thousands and thousands of dollars, but they don't." If no one felt like shopping around, I wondered what that would mean for his business.
"What margins are you taking?" I asked.
"Good margins, but not rip-offs like many funeral homes. That's the opportunity. We can beat the funeral home prices and still make a tidy profit. So this is a price-cutter's business. You're competing on price." He reached out again and flipped back a few pages. "Price, convenience, and information. It's the information age, and information is what sells on the internet.
We give you the information you need about the product in the quiet of your home. We'll do the price comparison shopping